Well, good morning, everybody. Thanks for turning up. Great turnout this morning, and I don't think you'll be disappointed. As I've said to a couple of people, that every time I speak to Mark, I find another gem that he drops out. And I keep saying to him, why don't you keep telling me this? In the beginning, he said, oh, well, I don't want to blow my own trumpet. I don't want it to sound as though I'm, you know. And it's just, most of us have probably never met anybody of international fame, and he's got a whole long list of them.
Nor have I.
But to start with, first of all, welcome to you all. As I always tell you, I do appreciate you turning up on a Saturday morning to come to these breakfasts. Let's just pray for Mark as he starts. Lord, we do thank you for Mark being prepared to talk to us about his really interesting journey in life and how he's seen God's hand in all of that. And we just pray, Lord, that it'll be an inspiration for those of us that are listening today, and that we'll be able to take something away with us from this morning that will help us in our own lives. And we just commit Mark to you, Lord. We just pray that you'll help him to not be too nervous and to just speak honestly and openly about his experiences. In your name we pray.
Amen.
So without further ado, what I've decided to do is to interview Mark, a bit like Parkinson, except I don't pretend to be Parkinson.
Don't mention that word. Parkinson's.
Parkinson's. He's got Parkinson's and I'm trying to be like Parkinson. The reason is because it's, you know, Mark is so reluctant to talk about himself that I've felt the easiest way to make sure it comes out is to sort of try and interview him in the process. So Mark, let's start off with your childhood, because that had a big bearing on your life, what happened in the future. So give us an outline of your background, your parents, where you were living.
My father is the center starting point here, because he went there after the war to Sydney, a college there for colonial administration, and did a course in Pacific administration for the government. Passed that, and in 1947 went up to Finchhaven on the coast of New Guinea, a very tropical little township that had its fame with the Second World War, and started off as a patrol officer. Now, if you have time to look in on the internet, KIAP, K-I-A-P, or patrol officer, it'll give you a very comprehensive listing of the jobs entailed. In 1951, Mum came down to Sydney to have me, because the medical facilities in New Guinea were totally inadequate, and went up to Finchhaven on the Bololo, which is a ship. But because of the tropical heat, I reacted to it. So at that time, MAF, who you know, Andy Little, as one of the pilots for MAF, were just being started up there, and I was one of the first passengers on their first aircraft that took me up into the Highlands. Years later, I found out that a couple of months later, the Pioneer pilot and his plane crashed in the Highlands, which confirms the perils of flying in the Highlands.
But tell me about some of your time about starting to become a Christian.
Oh, sorry, yes. Well, firstly, to give you a bit of an understanding, lived in a spirit world. Everything was governed by spirits, and we went to a place called Warbag, which is in the Highlands. And I was about three or four then, and spirits ruled everything. So Dad put on a film, black and white, with old Bell and Howell projector, with a screen out the front, out in the open. And that was a Tarzan film. And the warriors went with their axes and their spears, ready for a fight. And when they saw this film, it was a great mystical thing, and they ran around the back of the screen to see where everyone was coming from. And Tarzan was being pursued by lions, and of course there's a big gasp at the back there, and all across everyone's head came the spears straight through the screen, which stuffed up the rest of the film. But we were living in a spirit world, and I was brought up in the spirit world, and everything was then who was going to point a bone at somebody else. And then we went to, when I was about four, went to Daru, which is on the mouth of the Fly River, a swamp-fested malaria place, because Dad was being promoted. We had electricity by this stage. There was the Lutheran missionaries were very big in New Guinea at that stage from the 30s, 40s and 50s. And we went to a Sunday school, and I was confused by the spirits and the Lord's spirit. And I was anxious that the spirits were working against everybody and not loving. And I remember to this day the Lutheran missionary saying, "Remember, Mark, the Lord loves you and will protect you for the rest of your life. Be with him." And it gave me great peace. But the trouble is, every time I wanted to discuss this with my parents, there was arguments, because Dad was anti-Christ and Mum was a dormant, as it were, Catholic. So they'd always have arguments, which I felt that I was the cause of it. And I, to this day, can still see the arguments. This is why I'm stirring up all these memories to talk to you about that I haven't really mentioned before.
Yeah, so it was difficult. So you, the Lutheran missionary, you found out about Jesus, but yes. You couldn't actually develop that with your own parents, because it just started an argument every time.
Every time.
So you withdrew within yourself.
Well, I found that this is the thing that I was after, was the spirit of the Lord being with you, that is actually someone good and loving and caring. And whereas the native spirits are all victimising each other. I remember seeing a spirit woman who was always dressed up in long, lanky gear and colourful, and she governed the village. And because they always have the payback system, if someone dies mysteriously, it might be a heart attack, the reason is someone cursed them. And they found this bloke to blame, and she pointed, and I'm telling you the truth here, I remember vividly, she pointed a bone at him. 24 hours, he was dead. The spirit world governed everything, and there was no logic in it. It was just pure fear. And then they'd say, "Oh, well, it wasn't our tribe, it was the next tribe throwing a curse on someone." Or they'd blame the women for cursing someone because they're not well. So that type of spirit world, compared to what the Lutheran missionary was saying to me, that there is a loving Lord that will look after you, I wanted to discuss with my parents, and I never got to do it. So I was having an emotional build-up.
And what was it? You're on your father's side of the family, they told you something about praying, didn't they?
Now, this is something that I found very telling, was that I'd ask my aunties, "What about praying?" "Oh, always pray for someone else. There's people in China and other countries in need, not yourself. That's being selfish, so you can't pray for yourself." And I said, "Why not? Isn't he a loving God?" Well, I didn't know then that they were anti-Christ as well, and they had a warped sense of understanding of the Lord. And this is as a young child, that that you're like a sponge absorbing all this information, and what your parents tell you must be true. And therefore, I didn't question, but I had this longing to talk to the Lord, because the missionary was a good person who was telling me that I could pray to the Lord and be with the Lord. But my parents and family were saying, "No, you can't, that's being selfish. Only pray for others." But I didn't know how to pray. And oftentimes we've never been taught to pray properly to the Lord, to be engaged with the Lord, and I couldn't engage with the Lord.
So then you got sent off to boarding school, didn't you?
Well, then we went to Mount Hagen. We moved around a few places, because every 2 years Dad was promoted and sent to trouble spots, because he was an engineer as well as he achieved everything in his life. And that was another burden. Dad was in Z Force during the war. He was in Special Operations Group before that. He was ducks of the police. He was ducks of the everything else he had. So I had this level of expectation on me. Some of it was self-imposed, that my father achieved everything and I was a dunce. The schooling literally was that the teachers would go and have a party the night before, stay up drinking because of the social life, and then come into the school and lie sit at the desk and then fall asleep, so we'd go off and play. So the levels of education, it was good because I love being outdoors, but I was thick as a plank because no one was there as mentoring. And this is something that's so important, having the right mentors. And so the education was failing, and the brutality of the teachers in the 50s and early 60s was such that they stuck me in the corner with a dunce's hat on. So I had anxiety building on anxiety, and none of the kids, thankfully, they were just thankful it wasn't them with a dunce's hat on, because they were just as bad. So Dad thought, well, we've got to send them to boarding school because that's the only way I'll get educated. So visualise this, if you would, 11-year-old in the highlands of New Guinea, being told by my parents, you're going down to Toowoomba Grammar. And I said, who? Where? Toowoomba in Queensland. You're going to boarding school aged 11. The plane, a DC-3, was revving up. Dad comes from work because he was a high court judge by this stage, sent me to boarding school. Pat on the head, righto, son, this will make you. Mum was in tears, but Dad, being the stiff upper lip type, pat on the head, get on the plane and make your way down to Brisbane, get on the bus, go to boarding school, to a strange, brutal environment, which was based on the British system of getting the cane all the time. That'll knock you into shape. So I went to boarding school, fearful, no friends, no one to confide in, and no one to pray to. And if you told someone something, which I made the mistake, it went around the school, and of course that was something that they in turn could latch on to have a go at me, because everyone was finding a way out, being young boys, and all of them scared would find something that someone else can be picked on and not them. So it was a world of anxiety, but the one thing that did do for me, it gave me an education. So I'm rambling on a bit.
It's all right. So in summary, it was a pretty traumatic experience for you, being a kid. And from a spiritual point of view, you were confused with the spirituality and PNG of spirits and the Christian side of things. You were getting from the Lutherans and getting no help from your parents. So you were totally confused, as I understand.
Well, yes, there was this dilemma. We were being a grammar school, we were obliged to go to church. And every Sunday we'd get dressed up in our uniform and go to church in the town. But it was high church and I didn't understand that, so that didn't help me.
So, but there were some positive, good things in your childhood. You told me about Mark, and that was because of your dad's position. You had quite a few celebrities come and stay with you, and ended up just your family and these celebrities sitting around the dinner table together.
Well, what had happened was that we had the biggest house in the township, and there weren't any hotels for anyone that was visiting to stay at, and they felt that staying with a family, they would be more conducive. And some of the many of the people passing through, because we had the issue of Indonesia potentially invading. We had the SAS up there that Dad worked with. Now, the names that I'm mentioning are only mentioned really not as a look at me situation, but because of their telling nature when we spoke to them. We had, who did I put down there?
Lord Mountbatten, you said, was probably the most influential to you.
Lord Mountbatten, he stayed with us, and he was on a goodwill tour with the part of the United Nations. And remember him staying with us, and they always had parties for him, but he always shunned them. He'd had too many. And even with the high position that he had as Viceroy of India and Commander-in-Chief during the Second World War, he was a very basic man, a very honourable man. And our cook boy would say to Mum, What are we going to have for dinner? And Mum would say, oh, I'll go and ask him, thinking he'd want something very highfalutin. And Mum said, well, what do you have for dinner? And she said, well, tonight being Monday or something, we have roast, because they get it flowing up from Australia. Oh, he said, roast, I haven't had a roast for a long time. Wonderful. And then Mum would say, what about sweet? or what do you have for sweets? Well, Mum said, tonight we have bread and butter pudding. Oh, I haven't had bread and butter pudding for years. He said, because everyone thinks that he's in that position, he must have the very best. He said, I long for a comfortable bed and a good night's sleep and good friendship and good conversation. And one of the things he said to me is, he said, remember that no matter how high up you get in life, you've still got to sit on your own backside. And these little gems stay with you and think that these are people that have got their own aspirations and we only see them from a distance and saying, oh, look, they must be extra special. He said, no, I just did it through hard work. No one, yeah, so I got a few hand lift-ups, but he said, if I can encourage you to be yourself. Marlon Brando stayed with us because he had been promoting Mutiny on the Bounty, and he'd be sitting there and everyone would be having a party for him, and all the people are standing there all very nervous, and I'm about, this is before I went to boarding school. Food was ready, but everyone to talk to Marlon Brando. Mr. Brando, yep, such and such a question, nope. Oh, okay, so much for that one. Boy, your turn to ask him a question. So this was going nowhere fast. And Mum's in the background there getting nervous. Oh, good grief, this is going down like a lead balloon. Quick, get the hors d'oeuvres out. Mark, go and give him... You know, you've heard of devils on horseback? Yeah. So out of the oven they come. Mr. Brando. Yep, looking up at me. Would you like an hors d'oeuvre? What are they? Devils on horseback, what are they? And I explain them. Yeah, I'll have one of those, thank you very much. Oi, how come that kid can get some conversation out of him, we can't? But when we spoke to him, the party went and he said, I'm a basic person. I need the same things everyone else does. I get anxious like everyone else does. I'm not used to the high life. I enjoy acting, but all the paraphernalia that goes with it is not me. And if you see through his life, he was of that ilk. He hadn't changed. He is a marvellous actor, deep in thought, commitment to the preservation of life and to the minorities. And U Thant was the Indonesian General Secretary of the United Nations, stayed with us because of the concern. I think he was Malaysian, of the invasion by Indonesia into New Guinea and the ramifications of Australia. And again, he was a very honourable man, looking for the best in everyone. So a lot of these peers to me, giving me a focal point for life, that when you speak to them on a one-to-one, they still go to the toilet as we do, they still need to eat as we do, they still have the same aspirations as we do. So it showed me that no matter who they are, once you get to know them on a one-to-one basis, that they're people like us.
So, Mike, when you finished your school, you were, when we were having a discussion, you were pretty confused about, and you were really trying to find yourself, weren't you?
Well, first thing, I found girls. Now, the reason I say that is because in 1967 we were attacked in our house in New Guinea because of a payback, and our cook boy and his family, who were living from here to the kitchen away from us and a couple of other houses, got attacked, and he and his family got hacked to death. And we had a bit of a bun fight with the natives when my father had a Bren gun, and he opened up on them because they were going to kill us. He didn't kill them, he just fired into the air and into the ground. But what that showed was that law and order was breaking down there. So Dad moved down from New Guinea back to Melbourne, and I came from boarding school to Balwyn, where we lived, and I went to Balwyn High. And there was this marvellous, confusing revelation of girls, because I'd been in boarding school. I'm still confused now, mind you.
I think we all are, probably.
The Lord has a sense of humour. So I've forgotten the question now. Oh, so, but all through this, is the longing to know the Lord. I didn't know it in as many words. I'm reflecting back on this now, but I had a hankering to know more. I felt an emptiness. I finished matriculation and majored, if that's the word, in economics and maths. Now I can't count two and two anymore, but I still had this longing in me to find and search for love and understanding. Mum and Dad were still arguing over everything. It was a telling, and I felt always anxious that if I asked them anything, no matter what it was, it would end in a bun fight. So I had this longing in me to search. And so I worked a couple of years in Melbourne and then started my life's journey, what I think would give me answers, by travelling. And I went to I'd heard about a kibbutz. Anyone been on a kibbutz? No?
It's all the rage in the 70s.
It was the rage in the 70s. Or some of you are a bit too young, aren't you? And I found out about a kibbutz and applied. I wanted somewhere that was away from any fighting and the like, just in a peaceful area, because I'd heard about the Six-Day War and the conflicts. And I ended up right on the Lebanese border up in the upper Galilee, picking fruit and sharing with the other kibbutzniks. And we had barbed wire around the kibbutz and machine gun towers.
And another celebrity up there as well with you.
Well, as luck would have it, sorry about this. Have you heard of Moshe Dayan? He was the former commander-in-chief during the Six-Day War and then defence minister, but he gave up the defence ministership because he couldn't handle the politics. And I saw this man picking fruit. He was on the ground up into the trees picking apples, I think it was, and I was up in a cherry picker. And I thought, I know, I can familiar-looking face, because he had the patch on his eye. And I said, you wouldn't be Mr. Dayan. He said, I'm Moshe. And so we picked fruit together, because I was up there for 9 months. And so we oftentimes, 6 o'clock in the morning, we're in the morning shift, go down in and pick fruit and then have a breakfast of yogurt, honey and the like. And he said to me, you know, wars will never accomplish anything other than brutality for the next generation. He said, one of the problems we haven't learnt in our country is where we set up it through our industry, sprinkler systems and swimming pools and the like. Next door, there is the Arab woman there going and fetching water from a well and being hungry. And they look across the barbed wire and see people lounging around, enjoying the sprinklers, taking their water, and it builds up hatred for the next generation. So he said, until such time as we confront these issues, we'll carry on fighting. And how proven right he is. Did anyone go and see The Gatekeeper, that film, a couple of years ago from here?
Yeah, some people have put their hand up, Mark.
Well, he's reflecting earlier on what they've... Because The Gatekeeper is about all the former heads of Mossad, who have all said the same thing in hindsight. All this fighting is never going to solve anything. We've got to confront the issues with the people and stop the cycle of violence, the young people throwing rocks and them in turn being angry. So I picked fruit with Moshe Dayan for quite some time until my timing has never been good. Because one Friday night, it was coming up to Yom Kippur, and we finish early on a Friday because of prayers, and normally you had all the machine gun towers with their 50 caliber. We were from here down to the shopping centre away from the Lebanese border, and normally we'd have the machine gun towers and they had searchlights. Why they'd make them put a kibbutz there, I'll never know, but we came home that Friday night afternoon and I'm looking around, this eerie feeling that something's wrong. There was no guards in there. The armoured vehicles had gone. And I said to the locals, where's the army? Oh, they've gone home for prayers. Yeah, it's Yom Kippur, you goose. Don't you know that? And I said, yes, but that's left us unguarded. No, she'll be right. And I had this air of foreboding. And We stayed in huts that were about three quarters the length of the auditorium, wooden huts, ex-army. And about 3 or 4 in the morning, sound asleep, the mortars rained in and flattened the building. I say fortunately it killed a lot of my friends there, but it hit the other end of the building. I rose up in the out of bed then, got blasted in the aftermath of the explosion, and all the splinters hit me all over my body like 1,000 bits of wood, and blew my eardrums in. And immediately, this is the breakthrough for me, was the start of the breakthrough, was I prayed to the Lord, "Lord, please help me." And it was instinctive, it was self-preservating, but I prayed to the Lord with all my heart and soul. And I got a feeling of response, and I dived in the centre of the building there. There was a bunker, and I dived into the bunker, and it saved me. But it was only because I didn't even think of getting into the bunker initially. I was panicked. But I believe it was the Lord telling me to get into the bunker, and it saved my life, and of quite a lot of deaths, which flattened and killed of quite a lot of people. Sorry, I'm rambling on again.
No, it's fine. Right. Just going back to, I just want to go back to PNG when you said your father told you about the Bren gun, but he actually gave you a gun to fire as well, didn't he?
I was taught, as we all were, to fire all manner of guns. We had a Sten gun, a Bren gun, and Berettas. Mum was taught to shoot, but Mum shot everything but the target. So what we did was we had in each room a gun. It's only because he knew that one day we might be attacked, and he had a Bren gun. And they were coming from the natives ready because, see, Dad was in a court case involving payback. This is where the dilemma is of meeting Western justice against their own justice of payback. And all the villagers around the district united to come into town and to butcher as many people as they could for revenge for their people being put on trial. And when the natives gathered together and in a couple of the houses, they came to us, killed our cook boy and his wife. So Dad got his machine gun ready and told them to stop, but they kept advancing. They had their axes ready with their spears, ready to slaughter us. There was no half measures. So Dad was in with the main thrust of them. They came around the other side of the house, and I had a Beretta. My younger brother had older brother had a Beretta as well. And we fired off magazine after magazine, mainly into the air, but also into the ground. We hit a few ankles and legs, but thankfully we didn't kill anyone, but that was a sign.
How old were you when that?
Because we came back on, because it was Christmas. We came back from boarding school, so it would have been about 14.
At 14, you were firing a Beretta, and oh my goodness. Okay, let's
see,
move
this
on.
This is why I didn't want to say these things to you, because it would get them out of context and saying that I'm boasting or that.
No, Mark, it's not. Don't worry about that. We're trying to hear your story. This is your story. So in Israel, you left Israel after the Yom Kippur War, didn't you, I think? Is that right?
I did. There was nothing functional for us to do, and I was having my ears. Doctor said, "You'll be right." Every country's got this, "She'll be right, mate," approach, even their technical staff. "Now, you'll be right. Just get out there and get into the fresh air. There's nothing more that we can do for you." So I went to Lebanon then, because of the Australian passport. I went into Lebanon and Beirut. And I then went down to into Egypt and got a job on a barge. I was walking along there at one of the little ports there and started to talk to the locals, and they said, immediately ask you where you're from. "Oh, Australia. Yes, we knew the Australians during the war. My grandfather knew the Australians during the First World War. Honourable." So there was an immediate connect. This is one of the good things Australians have done. And all the Canadians had their own flag on their gear so that they weren't mistaken for Americans. And so I got a job on the barge, sailing up and down, delivering cargo, taking them off and then putting them back getting new cargo and up and down the Nile and sharing with them. And one of the things I'd learned very quickly in the piece is parents, no matter where they're from, want to have the same aspirations for their families. They want to have education for their kids and peace. So we had many a long discussion at night, and I'm learning more than I'm actually giving, because I'm like a sponge at that stage in my early 20s. But I still had a longing to know.
Because I want to move you on to America, because you went from there. You went on to England, didn't you? And then somebody suggested there might be a job for you in America. So just tell us about that job, and tell it from the beginning, as you told me about how you started that job. And
well, I went on to England then, and came back to Melbourne. And my uncle, so here I go again, thinking as if I'm bragging. My uncle was Deputy Prime Minister and Foreign Minister, and he knew the ambassador in Washington. This is in early 74 by then. And my uncle said, "What do you want to do?" And I said, "I'm really not sure. I haven't really accomplished what I want." He said, "Well, what about a job in America?" "Oh, sounds as good as everywhere that I've been so far." And his friend was a Mr. Green. And he said, rang him up and got me a job, and I flew straight over to Washington. This is from Melbourne. Got there, put a suit on. I got accommodation with other Australians. There's a story in itself. But next morning, bleary-eyed, standing at the desk there. Right, Mark, what you do is, as the people come in...
But what's the job first? You haven't said
Sorry, security guard. We had one pistol and one bullet. And I looked down the barrel of the gun there, and I saw more rust than I saw of the... looking down, thinking, "Oh, my goodness, this gun here will blow up in your face." And I had to find the bullet was in a drawer somewhere. And the bloke in charge said, "Right, Mark, as they come in, the guests, get them, bring them over to the desk and get them to sign in, and then we'll direct them. Remember, this is Australian property. We have to wear the security. You make sure that no one just walks in." Not a problem. Looking up and down, no one so far. This man comes in, head down, deep in thought, briefcase in hand, walk past me. "Where does he think he's going?" "Excuse me, Mark, it's all right, let him go." "No, no, I've got him, don't worry." "Excuse me, sir." "Huh, what?" "Excuse me, sir, you just can't walk in here. This is Australian property." "What do you mean?" "Oh, no, sir, you've got to come in and sign in." "Mark, let him go, he's a bloody ambassador." "No, no, he's got to sign in." So Mr. comes over, "Sir, thank you very much for doing this. It's only just a standard request." And he said, "You're new here, aren't you?" "Yes, sir, just came in last night." "Ah, right." Starts writing his name. "Oh, Mr. Green, we've got an ambassador name, Mr. Green." That's my job gone, I thought. And I thought, "Oh, Mr. Green, would you like me to escort you to the lift?" "Look, Mark, Mark is it? Because I had a little sticker on. Actually," he said, "it's probably a good idea. We've been pretty laxed here." And I got to know Mr. Green quite well, because we'd do in the security, we had a key that was like a cylinder, and you had to go room to room and upstairs and downstairs and into the ambassador's room. And when I got to know, I say, "Excuse me, Mr. Ambassador." He'd say, "What's that?" "I've got to put the key in the lock at a certain time, otherwise it triggers the alarm." And I got to know him quite well. And so the time rolls on there, I'm working there, and he said, "Right, we're going to have a wine and cheese night, or a couple of them. I want you all to be on alert, in your best behaviour, and pour the wine and the cheeses out." And of course, you know that President Nixon was being impeached at that stage. He would come, and he said, the ambassador said, "Now be mindful that the President of the United States is coming." "Oh, is he now?" "And he'll have his minders with him. So, Mark, you give him the red wine, and so-and-so give him the white wine. And there'll be other guests as well, but just mingle and look relaxed. relaxed. And so I'd bring the wine over. And before I could get to the ambassador, it was all these minders. And I didn't know then that the president had a problem with alcohol. He had two drinks and he's slurring. But he loved because of his anxiety about being impeached. And sorry, I just got to move a bit. My legs are twitching. So I'd pass it past the minders and give the ambassador a glass. And Mr. President would say, "Hey, Mac. Mac's your name." And, "Yes, sir, that'll do. Have you got any spare cases to put in my car?" And I'd go, I'll just clear that with him. But for goodness sake, give him what he wants. And then he'd have a glass of white, and then his entourage would close around him not to give him any more drinks. But I'd go out the back into the storeroom there, and his limousine would be around the back with the driver in there. Take a case of red and a case of white and put it in the boot. And then I'd say to the driver there, who was Negro, "Would you like a drink?" He said, "You know, you're one of the few people since I've had this job that offered me a drink." And I said, "Why not? You've got a very good job." He said, "Yes, but I'm black." And I said, "I wonder what the colour of your skin was." And he'd say, you mustn't have the same prejudice that we have here. Of course, then I think particularly since same now that it was 80% black, 80% unemployment, and the poverty there was very bad. So I'd give the driver some drinks as well. And this went on a couple of times. Then I got to know the president on a name basis, and all his anxiety. And then he asked me a very surprising but interesting question. "Hey, Mark," he said, very pointedly, "are you a Christian?" And without hesitating or feeling uncomfortable, I said, "Yes, I am." And it was the first time for me is saying to myself, "I am a Christian," because I didn't know how to, I never put that question to myself beforehand. "Are you a Christian?" And with my faith believing as there, that because I'd prayed to the Lord on the kibbutz and he answered me, that I could honestly say yes, and the president visibly relaxed and said, "Wonderful."
And his security guards had to taste the wine before he gave it to the president, didn't
they? Oh, yeah, did we taste the wine? Hey, Mr. President, we've had a bit of a tasting. Sorry, there's only a glass left in the bottle.
Anyway, let's move on, yeah. Mark, because...
Times are waiting.
Well, you seem to be attracted to war. Because the next thing you did, tell us about the story when, as an Australian in the UK, you went back to the UK. Well, first of all, before you did that, you actually got married, didn't you, before you went off to the Falklands?
Well, again, I'm still journeying because after leaving America, because the president was being impeached. Oh, sorry, the reason I left America was that I was confronted one night with security on a roster basis. I finished at midnight. And I went out the front of the embassy, and there was two local bother boys there, and saying that they saw me come out of the embassy thinking he must be rich, and I had no money because I was only paid $40 a week back then. And they demanded money from me, and I'd done at high school karate and got to brown belt, and self-preservation came in and I thumped them both and ran. One of them had a split lip and one of them went away bow-legged after I kicked him in the crutch. But I then moved... Again, I'm still in search mode. And I went to London and met my then wife on a bus in London, brought her back and got married in 1975 in November. But because she was... anxious to be back at Liverpool, we moved to Liverpool in 1976. I'm paraphrasing everything very quickly. And I had a very nasty mother-in-law who didn't love her daughter. Annette, as it turned out, found out that she went to boarding school when she was 9 because they lived in India. And she was sent to boarding school, so she felt rejected by her parents. So we both had the same criteria, as in a way. And so she was a manic depressant. Is that the right word? But she suffered badly from depression. And I didn't understand what it was. So I thought it was the me problem. It must be my fault. And so what I did was I joined the Naval Reserve to get away. I had a mother-in-law who I had no relationship with and a depressed wife. So I joined the Naval Reserve in 1980 to be on the mine hunters from Liverpool, because we went into the North Sea to sweep the seas around the oil fields up in the North Sea because of the Cold War. That was going great guns. I got away for long weekends, but then the mother-in-law say, "See yourself." Everything was me being selfish, but I just needed to have a bit of my own time. And of course, Margaret Thatcher decides that she didn't want the Falklands invaded by the Argentinians. So I'm in a good place until these wars come along.
You seem to be attracted to them. So tell us about what happened. Tell us about how you got called up to the Falklands.
Well, what had happened was that they realised that they were going to convert the Canberra, which was a cruise ship, into a troop ship. And that was going to be the main thrust of the invasion, was having this, I've forgotten whether 6,000 or 9,000 elite of Marines and paratroopers and the like on the Canberra going down. But of course they knew that the Argentinians had laid a lot of mines. Now the mine hunters, one of them that we were on, was just over 70 foot, I think about 90 foot wooden, 70 feet in the old wooden structure from the 60s that wasn't really built for the Atlantic. It was more for coastal conditions, but they had nothing else. So we went down before it was actually... it was never properly declared war, but we went down at night, went down into the Atlantic, three of us, three ships. I was seconded from the Naval Reserve into the Navy. Sorry, I haven't got back to the... I get a phone call at work. Is that Mark Robb with my serial number? Yes, this is Captain so-and-so. And I said, for goodness sake, you're imitating an officer. You know that is an offence. Look, we haven't got time to muck around. Hold on a tick. This is Rear Admiral so-and-so at Whitehall. Put me through to your office manager. And I could see through the door there visibly the office manager gets the call and stands to attention. So the message got through and I had to have my job secured. The phone call came back to me. Mark, if you object to partaking, that wasn't the words, but you're in the Navy, you've been seconded to the Navy now. If you're not there at 0400, so 1600 hours this afternoon down at the dock, you will be put in prison for 10 years. There's no if, buts or maybes. I stood to attention. And they said that if Mark doesn't have a job afterward, when he comes back, we have got the Navy to confront. And I went home, my wife said, "What are you doing home? You haven't been sacked, have you?" And I said, "Well, no, I've got another duty to do." "What's that?" "I'm going down to the Falklands." So I reported at 1600 hours. We set sail down into the Atlantic. I was a lieutenant in the Naval Reserve. I kept that rank in communications and navigation. I was on had a mixed crew, and we went down and then hit the South Atlantic and hit the raid. You've oftentimes heard of the storms in the Atlantic, and there's this leaky wooden structure hitting 13 metre, and I'm not exaggerating, we hit 13 metre waves. I was strapped, because most of the crew got seasick and I didn't, I was strapped into the wheel with a big band around my, a leather band around my stomach with all these springs holding me to the wheel. And for 3 days we rowed out the storm, getting more and more desperate. I had literally peed my pants because I couldn't get to the toilet. I was petrified, we all were. We just had to try and keep a steady course going through the waves. And I was getting to the point where I was really believing that we were going to be sunk. And immediately I prayed out to the Lord, "Lord, please help me." I'm in dire peril. And I got an answer straight away, as if the Lord's saying, I'm waiting for you to talk to me. And so often is the case, isn't it? The Lord's waiting to talk to us. And he said, be calm, be relaxed, we'll get you through this. And I immediately felt at ease, and they could see in my face that I was more relaxed. They said, what's happened to you? And I said, I prayed to the Lord, and they all did, the three of us that were in that area. So we got through down into the South Atlantic, but with the grace of God.
But didn't you say the storm started to subside almost straight after you prayed?
It was only half a day later that we could start to see the storm abating, and I knew that the Lord was laying the path ahead for us. And we got down into the Falklands area, and we were shadowed by two destroyers protecting us. And we found that what you do with a mine hunter is you lay out these cables that pick up where the mines are. I won't go into detail, it takes too long. And we were sweeping the waters around where the main ships were going to come down, and we picked up 18 mines before the Argentinians had laid. And if one of them would have hit the Canberra, the war would have been over, so we did a vital job.
Tell us about, you saw the Sheffield being sunk, didn't you? You were in the vicinity of the Sheffield when it was sunk by an Exocet. But tell us about the landing craft with the Welsh guards on it that were waiting to land at, where was it? Was it South Georgia or the Falklands they were going on to?
Into the Falklands.
Falklands.
Yeah. And we were in a protected cauldron there because we only had a 50 calibre machine gun, that was all, and I fired it a few times, but the Argentinian Air Force were very brave and very good. And the irony is with war, the Argentinian Air Force, most of them were trained by the Royal Air Force, had French equipment, and the French were friends with England. And when they were ready to land the landing barges, one of them had the Welsh guards on board, and they got hit by a missile and killed all the troops on board. And we were told to go and pick the bodies out of the water. And as we're leaning over, pulling up these charred bodies, and it still upsets me, their hands and bodies were slipping through. And today I can still smell them. The byproduct of war, I'm afraid. And there was no other witness there, and that shook all of us. And the thing was that there was nothing to help you afterwards, because when we got back to, they won the war. We put the bodies in what was roughly body bags then, because we were issued with them, because we were doing the salvage type work of any bodies, and got back to Liverpool, a pat on the head, right, get back to civilian life, all is back to normal. So you'd had all these emotions with you and no one to share with, because it was a very limited war, as it were, and they just wanted the victory sign, not those that were suffering post-traumatic shock. So when every time I go to a barbecue now, I have to brace myself, because I can still smell and see that, and had nightmares afterwards. Sorry.
So basically, when you came back from the war, you came back to your wife, which wasn't an easy situation, you were telling me. You had post-traumatic stress. You're still sort of searching. When we were talking, you said that you sort of probably rushed into the marriage because you were searching for love, and just the feeling of rejection you'd had all the time from your family. So it wasn't a great success, was it? And your wife also, as you've explained, had similar problems to you. So that was a real challenge. You went to Australia, didn't you? And you came to Torquay, and that was the beginning of the end, I think, wasn't it?
Well, you're right there, Bill. I'm looking back on that really summarises many years that oftentimes we're searching without finding, and then grasping onto something that we think would be the answer. And then it was only afterwards that I realised that Annette had the same issues. But she had no family to confide in. She was lonely. We were both lonely. but we didn't have the love for each other. I had the love, but because of her depression, she didn't know how to show love. So I thought to myself, staying in Liverpool wasn't any good. We'll come back to Melbourne. So in 1999, I came home and moved down to Torquay, which I thought would give her the peace and the tranquility and the beach and everything for her. Then her sister was dying from cancer. So she had the problem of her sister far away, and her sister was the only one that understood her. So that caused an extra layer of anxiety for us. Her sister eventually died with cancer, and we got to the point where we were both exhausted. So we'd been married, came up to 24 years without really much love in it. No Lord with us, and with the dramas that we'd had. In the year 2000, she had to go, felt that she had to go back and look after her mother. And I said, I'm not going back to England because we'll only really end up divorcing anyway. So she moved back to England. I moved up to Melbourne, got divorced by correspondence and moved into a unit in Ringwood. And I had got a unit. My family were supportive. She went back to England. And I got a job. I was feeling reasonably, not financially secure, but in a reasonable place, but I still didn't have the love that I wanted. Sleepless nights, anxious about where I was going for my future, still had no answers. So one night in desperation in 2000, I think in 2, I prayed to the Lord in desperation. How often it is in desperation that I said, Lord, I need your help. And the Lord says, oh, I'm here. I've always been there for you. How can I help you? Well, he knew that what the answer was. I said, I need to have someone to love. And he said, be calm and still. And I went into a deep sleep. This is on the Thursday night, I think it was, from work. I woke up refreshed and relaxed that all the tension had been taken from my body. And then came the Monday night. I was told in the meantime about dancing because I'd been to clubs and things like that. Everyone told me where to meet girls, and there was smoking in those days and a lot of drinking and at clubs and pubs and restaurants. And I was told about a ballroom dancing on Whitehorse Road, one of the church schools there, church halls there that had the dancing. I went up to the front of the class where they had the new recruits, as it were, there, and men were facing the women, and the women, and then they'd go through the moves, and then you'd come to your partner and do that manoeuvre. And I'd come up the front there, look up, there's Deb. And I just suddenly felt that the Lord saying, there she is for you. And so I do a dance with her. Hello, she said, all courteous. And then they say, right, now, I want you to swap partners. Deb would move down one shuffle and I'd move along one shuffle to her. And she said, you're supposed to change partners. I said, I've got the partner for the rest of my life here. Oh, she rather puzzled look. And they'd say, right, be mindful of your feet. And then I'd be just looking into her eyes and stepping on her feet. She said, you goose, you've got to watch your feet. And I said, I'm watching what I want to, thank you. So that was my journey start in life with Deb, and we got married in 2004. And the Lord's been good to me, to us both. And I've got two great stepsons who we've included in our lives journey. Wonderful parents-in-law, and she brought me to St. Alfred's in the old church there. Met Peter, who married us. It was the great day of our life, being married in that room over there, with many of you being part of my witness in the marriage and since, and life's journey with you all.
Now, there's one last thing to finish up, Mark, and that is a reconciliation with your father. You obviously had a pretty traumatic time with your father.
Oh, sorry, yes, yeah.
So just tell us about that, about how you reconciled with your father.
While I was in England there in 1985, Dad had suffered bad health with heart attacks and the like. I get a phone call in England from my brother. Dad's in hospital, he won't last long. Get on the plane and come home. He's desperate, he wants to talk to you. So I got a flight immediately, and praying all the while. I remember this so clearly, sitting there all the flight, please Lord, give me the chance to speak to Dad. And the Lord answered, and then they picked me up at the airport, rushed me to St. Vincent's Hospital in the city, and I had 4 hours with Dad before he died, and we reconciled. And one of the things that I found that I hadn't had the opportunity before, that I finally had with him, better late than never, that he was only 4 when his father died during the Depression, and the onus was on him to grow up quickly and be a man and look after his 2 sisters and his mother. And so he was an achiever by the need basis, and he was an anxious man that he only wanted the best for us, but he didn't know how to show it because he didn't have the parents to do so, because his father had died and his mother was desperate to keep the family together. So the relationship between parents and the kids is so important, that you praise your kids. And he said, I've been very privileged to know you, son. I haven't shown you my emotions because I don't know how to show them. So we reconciled very well, and I went away with a peacefulness that I hadn't had beforehand, and a better understanding of the anxieties of parents. And too often we don't communicate well enough, and that's why I've gave it my rule that I've say to Deb in our marriage, anything that is concerning you, let me know so we can talk it through together, that you know that you're not alone. Whereas with my father, he felt that he was alone, he didn't speak to me and I couldn't speak to him, because we didn't know how to talk to each other until the very end. So when he died while I was talking to him, but thankfully I had the grace and forgiveness of the Lord and the gift of talking to Dad before he died.
Well, Mark, that's great. And so I think you were saying to me yesterday when we were talking that looking back now, you realise that God had you in your hands throughout your whole life. And, you know, you've been able to reconcile with your father. Then the breakdown of your first marriage was amicable. You both realised, as you said, that you're exhausted of each other and just decided to go separate ways. But it was amicable, the split. And then you were able to find Deb, and it's been a fantastic experience for you, and this church and the people here that supported you.
Very much so. The thing that I hadn't learned until later was I didn't open up to the Lord on a daily basis. I only, only opened up quickly to the Lord in desperation times and then closed the door. And the Lord's been there all along. And it has been a learning process, but a wonderful process of opening up to. Every morning I get up and I pray to the Lord and thank him for this new day. Many a time I could have been killed in the conflicts that I've been in, and there were many, couple of other skirmishes as well that are another story. But all along the Lord has been saying, when you're ready, Mark, come to me. And this is what the Lutheran missionary said from the outset: remember, the Lord loves you. It's a gift, and prayer is a gift. And through my prayer group, my growth groups, and through this church and the ministry and your good wishes, your visitations to me, I've learned a lot about the gift of prayer and sharing. It's a wonderful gift that not many people are privileged enough to enjoy.
Mark, thanks very much. Mark has really opened up and given some real private parts to his life. He told me when he said about the dunce cap, never ever told anybody that before. He was so embarrassed about it. So, Mark, thanks very much for your honesty.
Thank you.